On a recent trip to Paris, I enjoyed a beautiful afternoon in a royal French wine cellar a block from the Louvre. Two crude lamps were hanging from a rustic vault, and before us a whole tableful of sparkling empty glasses awaited an impressive array of French wines. And as we drank, our wine expert taught us with a wonderful commentary. Now, I'm no wine expert and would never claim to be, but I learned a lot. So I've invited this man to join us to continue that education. His name is Olivier Magnier, and he is a young sommelier from Paris. Olivier, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick.
Olivier, I had such a beautiful afternoon with you. Tell us about your business and what you do in Paris.
Well, basically, what we do at Au Château is we try to explain French wine to people. People might come to France loving wine, but not really knowing much about French wine. We try to help them make sense of French wine. So we give wine tasting classes that are actually in English, and we have classes every day. We also do day trips to Champagne. We do cruises on the Seine River. And we also recently opened a wine bar.
You know, French wines have a great reputation among Americans. What do Europeans think of French wines?
Well, Europeans just love French wines, really. There's a lot of good wines, so it's hard not to like them. But I would say that some of the biggest consumers of French wine in the world are the UK, Belgium, Germany. So really our neighbors are big consumers of French wine. But it's funny because in Europe, you know, you have old ideas that basically stick. So when people want to buy cars or dishwashers, they think Germany, yes, France, no. And it's just the opposite for wine, which is actually kind of funny because, you know, the Germans make great wine and French cars are actually not that bad. So, but overall, you know, French wine, anybody who likes wine is going to like French wine at some point.
Now make some general observations for us about the character of wines from different French regions and how that relates to the experience you're going to have enjoying the wine and the prices.
In a nutshell, what you can remember about French wine that's going to be helpful is that if you like lighter wines, okay, you should stick to the northern part of France, so the Loire Valley, so Burgundy, Champagne, Alsace. If you prefer big, you know, fuller-bodied wines, well, you should head to the south where it's sunnier, so you're going to have more concentration. Also, you should remember that if you're going for the big names, you know, Bordeaux, Champagne, Burgundy, well, you're going to have to pay a big price. And if you're going for names that are not as well-known, the Languedoc, the Southwest, and such regions, well, that's where you're going to get really great value for your money.
So if you haven't heard of the region, Languedoc, Southwest, can you conclude the quality is less or it's just not marketed as well?
No, absolutely not. You find really good wines everywhere in France. A tip I give to my clients, if you're hesitating between two bottles that are at the same exact price, one that comes from a well-known area, one that comes from the not-so-well-known area, go for the one that's not so well known, because for the same price, it's usually going to be better. A region like the Languedoc, for instance, it's the largest wine producing region in the world. The Languedoc makes more wine than Australia. The Languedoc makes more wine than Argentina. And yet, most people have not even heard of the Languedoc. You know, most people, when they're looking for Shiraz, they look at Australian wines. Well, the Languedoc has three times more Shiraz planted than all of Australia. So really, French wine, the main thing to me that characterizes French wine is bad marketing. And to understand that is you have to look at the sociology of who is behind the wine, and basically they're farmers. So they're not corporations, they're not marketing people at all. They're just small farmers that try to make good wine, basically.
So you could get a high-end Languedoc wine, and it would cost less than a low-end Bordeaux and conceivably be a much better wine?
Absolutely. It's a different style because the grapes are a little bit different. But if you spend, I'd say, in America, if you spend $25, well, you're much, much better off going for a wine from the Southwest or from the Languedoc than you are spending it on Bordeaux. Actually, I would tell you, if you only have $25 to spend, just stay away from Bordeaux because the inflation for the good wines in Bordeaux has been so gigantic over the past few years that a good Bordeaux is going to be good, but it's going to be super expensive.
So the demand, just because it's a famous name and anybody wants a Bordeaux, the demand's going to drive the price up. Olivier, you mentioned that the southern part of France produces a heavier wine. Is it fair to say, if you compared Spanish wines and German wines, that's going to be generally really heavy and lighter? It would sort of be similar to the regions bordering France, Germany, and Spain?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you say is very true. Basically, the climate of where the grapes are grown has a tremendous impact on the grapes and therefore on the style of wine. So it's something that anybody can remember. The warmer the climate, the sunnier the area, the more concentration you're going to get. So it's going to make a big concentrated red wine, and it's also going to make for white wines that are a bit less fresh if you're in a really hot area. That's why if you look at a Champagne is very fresh, it's very crisp. It's also because it's bad weather in Champagne. You know, you go to Champagne most of the year, it's rainy, it's gray, it's pretty cold. Basically, if you want those crisp white wines, you got to step away from the sun.
Now, you mentioned the French are not very good marketers of their wine. I know that the name of the region is quite important, and some regions defend their name and others don't, and they pay the consequences. What are a couple of examples of that?
That is very true. You know, in America, people identify wine by the grape. You buy a Pinot Noir, Merlot. In France, not at all. And throughout Europe, basically, we talk about the regions. You know, you buy Bordeaux, Champagne, Beaujolais, Chianti in Italy. Those are regions, okay? And basically, when a name of a region becomes well-known, well, it creates a situation. And so that's what happened for Champagne, for instance. You know, the Champagne people started making sparkling wine all over the world, and they started calling it Champagne. It's like, well, it's, you know, it's bubbly, so it's Champagne. And the Champagne people were like, pop, you do whatever you please, but that's our name. You don't use our name.
So they've defended that word.
Yeah, and they sued. They went all out in terms of legal procedures, and they won. They won everywhere. And so therefore, they created basically a whole legal frame internationally where now you cannot use that word anymore. So they've going the extra mile legally has helped them and helped, I would say, everybody create a whole new field of law that has to do with the intellectual property of the origin of what we eat and drink. And it's typically what people in Chablis have not been able to do. Most people in the U.S. think that Chablis, you know, it's 2 gallons for $1.99 in a big box, and it's really bad wine. But if you look at the real French Chablis, so Appellation Chablis Contrôlée, that is actually really good wine. But since very early in history, it was very well known. And so the name Chablis was used all over the world. And they have not protected their name as well and as early as the Champagne people have. And therefore, now from North to South America and also in Australia, the name Chablis is not protected. So it can be, actually, if you look at the volumes of Chablis produced, they're mostly produced in South America, in California, and in Australia, not in France. But if you want the real Chablis, you should aim for the French one.
Do I recall seeing some wine labeled Method Champagne?
Yeah, Méthode Champenoise, or Champagne Method, which means that they use the same method as they do in Champagne.
Legally, you can get away with that. You can call it, this is
you
made.
You used to.
Oh, you can't do that anymore
to.
Either.
Wow. Yep, no. Now, any reference, and that's a new ruling, any reference to the word and the region Champagne is actually illegal now. So even Méthode Champenoise, the Champagne Method, they cannot do that anymore. So they usually say Méthode Traditionnelle, traditional method now.
What's your favorite sparkling wine outside of Champagne in France?
I think the Loire Valley has really good ones. I like the sparkling wines in Vouvray, for instance.
So
with the
really,
Chenin
you
Blanc,
can right? get a what we would think of as a Champagne in Vouvray or the Loire Valley. It has a different name, but it would be also very good.
Absolutely, and much cheaper. Every wine region in France actually produces sparkling wine. Hmm. You can get sparkling wine from Alsace,
but because
from Bordeaux,
they can't use the name Champagne, they can't charge what the market would bear. This is fascinating. We're speaking with Olivier Monnier, and his website is au-chateau.com. Au-chateau.com. We're talking about appreciating and enjoying French wine. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Bill's on the phone in Tonawanda, New York. Bill, thanks for your call.
Hello, Olivier.
Hello.
I have more of a general type question than anything. I'll go into a wine store, and this is a pretty decent-sized wine store, and in the French red wine section, they have prices ranging from, well, roughly 8 to probably 10 times that amount in dollars from basically any region you can imagine, you know, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Rhone, and with the thousands of vintners that France has, I have a tough time making a selection as far as trying to come up with a decent Merlot or Cabernet Sauvignon simply because there's such a variety and there's such a selection. So I was just simply wondering, how would you suggest, you know, someone going in and trying to, you know, identify what would be a good red wine, you know, from France? I mean, do you do it by year first? Do you do it by region? You know, could you elaborate a little possibly on that?
I'd say that most people in the States tend to know the grapes they like. You know, you prefer Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir. So what you can do at that point is find out which regions in France will grow these grapes. In France, and that's a huge difference with anywhere else in the world, each region specializes on a given set of grape varieties. Okay, so if you like the Pinot Noir, you have to go to Burgundy. If you like the Merlot, Bordeaux is a good destination. If you like Shiraz, the Languedoc is going to be great. If you like Sauvignon Blanc, that's going to be the Loire, and so on and so forth. Once you have identified the regions that might please you the most, then you're going to grow more familiar with the prices and potentially the names of the wineries that you're going to like. Okay, if you say, oh, I like a good Shiraz. If I want a big Shiraz, I'm going to go in the Languedoc. If I want a Shiraz that's going to be a bit more delicate, I'm going to go in the Rhone Valley. Okay, and in the Rhone Valley, in the States, you find some big names. You find Chapoutier, you find Jaboulet, you find Chave. And then you can know, you know, you can start exploring. I would say the vintage, so the year should come last, because the vintage has to do with basically the weather, but the weather in that specific region of the world. It's actually a great way to notice people who are completely full of it when it comes to wine. People will tell you, oh, you know, 2005, great year. We're like, where? You know, is that New Zealand? Is that Sonoma County? Is that, you know? So first, identify the grapes you like. Then that will tell you the regions. And then you can look into wineries and into vintages.
Oh, that's terrific. Okay.
You should do the wine tasting class at the beginning of your trip, because we have a lot of people do it at the end and say, oh, man, I wish I'd done it before. This way I could have ordered the wine better and more conveniently every time we went out.
Sounds like fun. Hey, Bill, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Bill, and see you soon then in Paris.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your suggestions, Olivier.
Happy travels, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Olivier, I hear this word terroir a lot. How do you define terroir?
Well, the best translation I found in English was somewhere-ness. The idea that if you are in a specific place, well, the local environment is going to give a unique taste to your grape and therefore to your wine. So you can have two Chardonnays. If they're grown in two different places, well, they have that potential for being different. And that's what the terroir is about.
So it's a combination of the climate, the soil, the culture, even the culture?
I would say soil, microclimate, geology, and also the people. You know, the people that are involved in making it, people today and people also yesterday. So the whole know-how that's been accumulated over the years.
So can you take a French grape and a French vintner to a different country with the same climate and duplicate the same quality wine?
No, sir. You can make very good wine, but each wine is absolutely unique. That's the nature of wine. Wine is not Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, it's a recipe, and so it's always the same. Wine is never the same because it's a natural product. It's just fermented grape juice. So where you are is always going to have an impact on the style of the wine you're going to make, should you want to reveal that uniqueness, of course.
How does topsoil shape the character of the wine?
Well, the soil is the most important thing to understand wine, because basically vine is a creeper. Okay, so the roots grow very deep. To give you an idea, a root can go as far as 150 feet down. Okay, so it's extremely deep. So meaning you're going to cross all of these geological layers, you know, each having its own little fauna and flora and bacterial activity. So all this is going to feed the roots with a unique taste of that place. And therefore, the grape will come up with a unique taste, which is the taste of that place, of that very terroir. So there is no understanding wine if you don't realize how much wine has to do with the soil and how wine has to do with geology.
So the vintner can shape or influence the character of the topsoil, but the deeper geology is really tied to the history of that land, and that's what the vines are looking for?
Absolutely. You know, it's actually interesting because in France it's illegal to irrigate vine. And we do not allow this because basically if you irrigate vine, which is something you find all over the rest of the world of wine, they do drip irrigation, okay? So they feed water on the surface. If you do this, the roots are going to grow because it's their nature, but they grow horizontally instead of growing vertically, instead of going down. So those roots never leave the superficial layer. So meaning the true uniqueness, the true singularity of your soil, you're not going to express it. So it's actually with a single piece of regulation, like the absence of irrigation, that's going to trigger a fantastic diversity in the wines produced in France.
A lot of vintners in my travels have made a big deal about their oak barrels, and I never hear French vintners bragging about oak barrels.
In France, we like to look at oak as makeup for a woman. You know, a little bit of makeup is good. If the first thing you notice about a woman is her makeup, yeah, you might lose a bit of elegance. And oak is a bit the same. You know, a little bit is good.
So not too oaky there. When we're tasting wine, a lot of us rookies just think dry, sweet, fruity, oaky, this sort of thing. What are some key words that can expand our vocabulary so we can actually identify characteristics that are important?
Well, I would say think of the words you would use to describe a person. You know, you're at a restaurant, think of the words you would use to describe the person in front of you. You know, a wine can be shy, it can be exuberant, it can be loud, it can be tender, it can be soft, it can be shallow, it can be boring. To me, those are much better terms. Hmm. Also because frequently when people use the words dry, sweet, they don't really understand what it means. So it might lead to more, you know, blur between you and the person you're trying to express your wine preferences mm-hmm. to.
When you look at a lot of people in wine tastings, they'll suck in air as they're tasting the wine or they'll actually chew the wine. What's going on there and what is actually helpful?
It's basically oxygen has a big impact and it's going to help release the aromas, okay? And the aromas of wine are pretty volatile. So when you subject them to oxygen, it's going to make your wine much more loud, much more, it will bring out its flavors and aromas. It's the same logic basically when you decant the wine and when you let the wine breathe, it's just putting oxygen in contact with the wine. Looking at your wine with a magnifying glass, you know.
What do you look for in a good white wine?
I like my white wines to be crisp, to be fresh. You know, I like a refreshing white wine. That's, to me, the greatest quality. And that's something I love about French whites is that they're so crisp and so fresh.
What about legs? People talk a lot about the legs. When they swish the glass, they look at the little drips coming down and say, nice legs.
Absolutely. Those legs, two things in those, sugar and alcohol, okay? So basically, if you have a white wine, in white, alcohol is relatively steady, so the legs will highlight the sugar content. So you'll be able to see whether it's dry, that's low sugar, sweet, that's high sugar. For reds, it's less clear-cut, so you're going to be able to say if it's going to be a lighter wine if it has a few legs, or a bigger, stronger wines if it has a lot of legs, if they're much faster, more thick as well.
Why is French wine so diverse? I mean, there must be 1,000 different French wines in one country.
Well, first, volumes. You know, France is the largest wine-producing country in the world. We make 24% of all the wines in the world. So necessarily, we're going to have a lot of diversity. The geography as well. France is a very small country, but basically all the climates you find in the world, you'll find them somewhere in France. And then, of course, we have that history and the culture to preserve and to express that local variety. We're not in the culture of making high volumes of similar wines. You know, of branded wines, of big brands, of Yellowtail, of Gallo. France is not about this at all. It's a bunch of very small people. So for consumers, it might be a bit like overwhelming, like, oh my God, it's so... But please, I really ask to give those wines a chance because if we don't, the wine industry is going to be like every other industry in the world. It's just going to be McDonald's and so on. It's going to be like three companies running the show, which is basically already the case in California, already the case in Australia. So resistance, my friends. Go for the smaller names.
Because that's what you think on a global scale. Wine is really being consolidated into a few big growers. And in France, we don't have that. Is the government actually having policies that protects the small vintner?
Not really. It's really culturally first. The French are not very much inclined to buying from big brands when it comes to wine.
Okay.
And then the fact that what they do is good, so they can be rather prosperous. And really, that diversity of wineries... Basically, to give you some numbers, California has around 2,000 wineries. France, as a comparison, has a bit more than 150,000. So it's just gigantic, you know? And each winery will produce, I don't know, 5 to 10 different wines every year. So the diversity is very much out there. And we need to help these people stay alive. I'm not talking as a Frenchman. I'm really talking as a, you know... Well, Rick, you've traveled all over the world, and you probably realize that everywhere you travel, you find McDonald's, you find Starbucks, you find Pizza Hut, you find all these big chains everywhere. And that's because we, consumers, we buy from them, you know. But mm-hmm. if we stop spending our money with the same big corporations and redirected our money to the smaller people, it would make for a much more interesting and tasteful world, I believe.
Okay, so the survival of the small vintner in France is because of a savvy market that appreciates the value of having healthy small vintners. What impact do the French vintners see on their wines because of climate change?
Well, worldwide, I think that you can see temperatures are rising and have risen over the years. And you know there's two types of maturities in the grapes? You basically harvest when you have enough sugar, and so that's due directly to the sunshine. But there's another aspect, which is the ripeness of the tannins, of the skin, basically. And there used to be a difference of 2 or 3 days between the moment the sugar ready and the moment the tannins were ready. And now, since temperatures have risen, you have more like 2 or 3 weeks. So meaning in the meantime, you have to wait for the tannins, for the skins to be ripe. And so you harvest with much higher sugar concentration, which leads to the escalation that we all witness in terms of alcohol concentration in our wine. It used to be 12, 13%. Now it's frequently 14, 15, sometimes 16. sometimes even more percent alcohol. And that's all due to climate change.
The alcohol level's going up and the sweetness is going up because the climate is changing.
Absolutely. There's two things. One, people who are newcomers to wine like sweet, they like heavy, they like rich. It's an easier thing to like. So there's an incentive from a marketing standpoint to produce that style of wine. And then there's also the climate, which basically doesn't leave you much of a choice. If you're in Napa Valley and you want to make a red wine, it's going to be very hard to make it less than 14% alcohol.
And then what's the right temperature to drink a red wine? I think there's a little confusion about that lately.
Well, yeah, because, you know, everybody says room temperature, but the expression room temperature came from times where the rooms we lived in were much cooler in terms of temperature than they are today. So I think we have a tendency to serve red wine a bit too warm. You know, it's perfectly acceptable to put your wine in the refrigerator for a few minutes before you drink it. So I think we serve reds a bit too warm and white wines a bit too cold, a bit too chilled. Take them out of the fridge a little bit before you drink them. You'll see you'll make both the reds and the whites much more drinkable.
I'm glad you said that because I would like the red to be a little cooler than how it's normally served. You could even ask at a restaurant to chill it for a while.
Oh, yeah, fully acceptable. Don't be shy.
5 or 10 minutes in the fridge and it'll be better for you.
I agree.
Olivier, take me to a beautiful place to enjoy a glass of wine with you, and let's look at the view and share one tip on how we can better appreciate the wine culture of France.
I would say explore, you know, like go beyond your big names. Step away from Bordeaux, from Burgundy, and go for the lesser known names. You will save money and you'll have the excitement of discovery. There are 9,600 different sorts of grapes in the world. Your wine aficionado will know like 10 or 15. So explore. There's a whole world of under the radar wine. So just sit there and truly explore, because that's what traveling is about, really exploring, not only visually, but also in your plate and in your glass, something that's unique to that place.
Okay, then let's grab that glass of wine. Let's sit on a terrace and look out over a bit of France that really makes the package complete. Where would you take me and what would we drink?
I would take you to a hill in Alsace, which is, I believe, a completely underrated wine region, a lovely white wine in Alsace. And we would drink a lovely Pinot Gris. And we'd sit there and we'd watch the beautiful Alsatian villages and the churches, the smoke coming out of the chimneys, and we'd drink something really crisp and fresh. And the sunshine will not be too warm, just be warm enough, and it would just be a blast.
I can see it right now. Corduroy hills. I love it when the vines sort of make a corduroy pattern on the hills. And you know that just over the Rhine River is Germany. At your back are the Vosges Mountains. And on your table is a glass of beautiful Pinot Gris. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been speaking with Olivier Magnier. Olivier has a wine bar in Paris. He gives wine tastings and talks about wine. You can learn more about his work at his website, auchateau.com, o-chateau.com. And let's finish it with a toast, Olivier.
Well, I would take the words of our former president, Jacques Chirac, who whenever he would offer a toast, would raise his glass and would say, à nos chevaux, à nos femmes, et à ceux qui les montent. Which would translate into, to our horses, to our wives, and to those who ride them. Voilà. Vive la France.
Merci bien, Olivier Magnier.
Merci.
Rick Steves has spent a third of his adult life in Europe researching and writing guidebooks. His classic, Europe Through the Back Door, teaches the skills of smart travel. At Rick Steves' online travel store, you'll also find guidebooks for France, Paris, Provence and the Riviera, and Rick's French Phrasebook. To learn more about Rick's guidebooks for France and beyond, visit the travel store at ricksteves.com.